Chapter 21. Dolly came out of her room to the tea for the grown-ups. Stepan Arkadyevitch didn't come out. He must have left his wife's room by the other door.
"I'm afraid you'll be cold upstairs," observed Dolly, addressing Anna. "I want to move you downstairs, and we shall be nearer."
"Oh, please, don't trouble about me," answered Anna, looking intently into Dolly's face, trying to make out whether there had been a reconciliation or not.
"It will be lighter for you here," answered her sister-in-law.
"I assure you that I sleep anywhere, and always like a dormouse."
"What's it all about?"
inquired Stepan Arkadyevitch, coming out of his room and addressing his wife. From his tone, both Kitty and Anna knew that a reconciliation had taken place.
"I want to move Anna downstairs, but we must change the curtains. No one knows how to do it. I must see to it myself," answered Dolly, addressing him.
God knows whether they are fully reconciled, thought Anna, hearing her tone cold and composed.
Oh, nonsense, Dolly, always making difficulties, answered her husband. Come, I'll do it all, if you like.
Yes, they must be reconciled, thought Anna.
I know how you do everything, answered Dolly. You tell Matvey to do what can't be done, and go away yourself, leaving him to make a mess of everything.
And her habitual mocking smile curved the corners of Dolly's lips as she spoke.
Full, full reconciliation. Full, thought Anna. Thank God.
And rejoicing that she was the cause of it, she went up to Dolly and kissed her.
Not at all. Why do you always look down on me and Matvey? Said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling hardly perceptibly and addressing his wife.
The whole evening Dolly was, as always, a little ironical in her tone toward her husband, while Stepan Arkadyevitch was happy and cheerful, but not so as to seem as though, having been forgiven, he had forgotten his offence. At 9:30, a particularly joyful and pleasant family conversation over the tea-table at the Oblonskys' was broken up by an apparently simple incident. But this simple incident, for some reason, struck everyone as strange. Talking about common acquaintances in Petersburg, Anna got up quickly.
"She's in my album," she said.
"And by the way, I'll show you my Seryozha," she added, with a mother's smile of pride.
Toward 10 o'clock, when she usually said good night to her son, and often before going to a ball put him to bed herself, she felt depressed at being so far from him, and whatever she was talking about, she kept returning to her thoughts of her curly-headed Seryozha. She longed to look at his photograph and talk of him. Seizing the first pretext, she got up, and with her light, resolute step, went for her album. The stairs up to her room came out on the landing of the large, heated main staircase. Just as she was leaving the drawing-room, a ring was heard in the hall.
"Who can that be?" said Dolly. "It's early for me to be fetched, and for anyone else it's late," observed Kitty.
"Sure to be someone with papers for me," put in Stepan Arkadyevitch.
When Anna was rounding the top of the staircase, a servant was running up to announce a visitor, while the visitor himself was standing under a lamp. Anna, glancing down, at once recognized Vronsky, and a strange feeling of pleasure and at the same time of dread of something stirred in her heart. He was standing still, not taking off his coat, pulling something out of his pocket. At the instant when she was just facing the stairs, he raised his eyes, catching sight of her, and into the expression of his face there passed a shade of embarrassment and fear. With a slight inclination of her head, she passed, hearing behind her Stepan Arkadyevitch's loud voice calling him to come up, and the quiet, soft and composed voice of Vronsky refusing. When Anna returned with the album, he was already gone, and Stepan Arkadyevitch was telling them that he had called to inquire about the dinner they were giving next day for a celebrity who had just arrived.
"And nothing would induce him to come up. What a strange fellow he is," added Stepan Arkadyevitch.
Kitty blushed. She thought that she was the only person who knew why he had come and why he wouldn't come up.
"He's been at home," she thought, "and didn't find me, and thought I should be here. But he didn't come up because he thought it late, and Anna's here."
All of them looked at each other, saying nothing, and began to look at Anna's album.
There was nothing either exceptional or strange in a man's calling at 9:30 on a friend to inquire details of a proposed dinner party and not coming in. Yet it seemed strange to all of them. Above all, it seemed strange and wrong to Anna. Chapter 22. The ball was only just beginning as Kitty and her mother walked up the grand staircase, flooded with light and lined with flowers and footmen in powder and red livery. From the rooms came a constant, steady hum, as from a beehive, and the rustle of movement. And, while on the landing, between the plants, they gave last touches to their hair and dress before the mirror, they heard from the ballroom the careful, distinct notes of the fiddles of the orchestra beginning the first waltz. A little old man in civilian clothes, arranging his grey curls before another mirror, and smelling of perfume, stumbled against them on the stairs, and stood aside, evidently admiring Kitty, whom he didn't know. A beardless youth, one of those society youths whom the old Prince Shchetchabatsky called young bucks, in an exceedingly open vest, straightening his white tie as he went, bowed to them, and after running by, came back to ask Kitty for a quadrille. As the first quadrille had already been given to Vronsky, she had to promise this youth the second. An officer, buttoning his glove, stood aside in the doorway, and stroking his moustache, admired the rosy Kitty. Although her dress, her coiffure, and all the preparations for the ball had cost Kitty great trouble and consideration, at this moment she walked into the ballroom in her elaborate tulle dress over a pink slip as easily and naturally as though all the rosettes and lace, all the minute details of her attire, had not cost her or her family a moment's attention, as though she had been born in that tulle and lace, with her hair done up high on her head and a rose and two leaves on the top of it. When, just before entering the ballroom, the princess, her mother, tried to straighten the ribbon of her sash, Kitty had drawn back a little. She felt that everything must be naturally right and graceful, and nothing could need adjusting. It was one of Kitty's best days. Her dress wasn't uncomfortable anywhere. Her lace bertha didn't droop anywhere. Her rosettes were not crushed or torn off. Her pink slippers with high, curved heels didn't pinch, but delighted her feet. And the thick rolls of fair chignon stayed up on her head as if they were her own hair. All three buttons fastened without tearing on the long glove that covered her hand without concealing its lines. The black velvet of her locket nestled with special softness around her neck. That velvet ribbon was delicious. At home, looking at her neck in the mirror, Kitty had felt that it was eloquent. About everything else, there might be a doubt, but the velvet was delicious. Kitty smiled here, too, at the ball when she glanced at it in the mirror. Her bare shoulders and arms gave her a sense of chill marble, a feeling she particularly liked. Her eyes sparkled, and her rosy lips couldn't keep from smiling from her awareness of her own attractiveness. She had scarcely entered the ballroom and reached the throng of ladies, all tulle, ribbons, lace, and flowers, waiting to be asked to dance. Kitty was never one of that throng. When she was asked for a waltz, and asked by the best partner, the first star in the hierarchy of the ballroom, a renowned dancing instructor, a married man, handsome and well-built, Yegorushka Kosansky. He had just left the Countess Barnina, with whom he had danced the first half of the waltz, and, scanning his kingdom, that is to say, a few couples who had started dancing, he caught sight of Kitty entering, and glided up to her with that peculiar, easy gait which is confined to directors of balls. Without even asking her if she cared to dance, he put out his arm to encircle her slender waist. She looked around for someone to give her fan to, and their hostess, smiling at her, took it. "How nice you've come at the right time," he said to her, embracing her waist. "Such a bad habit to be late." Bending her left hand, she laid it on his shoulder, and her little feet in their pink slippers began swiftly, lightly, and rhythmically moving over the slippery floor in time to the music. "It's a rest to waltz with you," he said to her as they fell into the first slow steps of the waltz. "It's exquisite, such lightness, precision." He said to her the same thing he said to almost all his partners, whom he knew well. She smiled at his praise, and continued to look about the room over his shoulder. She was not like a girl at her first ball, for whom all faces in the ballroom melt into one vision of fairyland. And she was not a girl who had gone the stale round of balls till every face in the ballroom was familiar and tiresome. But she was in the middle stage between these two. She was excited, and at the same time she had sufficient self-possession to be able to observe. In the left corner of the ballroom she saw the cream of society gathered together. There, incredibly naked, was the beauty Lydia, Korsunsky's wife. There was the hostess. There shone the bald head of Krivan, always to be found where the best people were. In that direction gazed the young men, not venturing to approach. There, too, her eyes found Stiva, and there she saw the exquisite figure and head of Anna in a black velvet gown. And he was there. Kitty hadn't seen him since the evening she refused Levin. With her far-sighted eyes, she knew him at once, and was even aware that he was looking at her.
"Another turn, eh? You're not tired?"
said Korsunsky, a little out of breath.
"No, thank you."
"Where shall I take you?"
"Madame Karenina's here, I think. Take me to her."
"Wherever you command."
And Korsunsky began waltzing, gradually slowing down, straight toward the group in the left corner, continually saying, "Pardon, mesdames, pardon, pardon, mesdames." And steering his course through the sea of lace, tulle, and ribbon, and not disarranging a feather, he turned his partner sharply round, so that her slim ankles in their mesh stockings were exposed to view, and her train floated out in fan shape and covered Krivan's knees. Korsunsky bowed, set straight his broad shirt front, and gave her his arm to conduct her to Anna Arkadyevna. Kitty, flushed, took her train from Krivan's knees, and a little giddy, looked around, seeking Anna. Anna was not in lilac, as Kitty had so urgently wished, but in a black, low-cut velvet gown, showing her full shoulders and bosom that looked as though carved of old ivory, and her rounded arms with tiny, slender wrists. The whole gown was trimmed with Venetian lace. In her black hair, all her own, was a little wreath of pansies, and there were more of the same in the black ribbon winding through the white lace encircling her waist. Her coiffure was not striking. All that was noticeable was the little wilful tendrils of her curly hair that would always break free about her neck and temples. Around her finely chiselled, strong neck was a thread of pearls. Kitty had been seeing Anna every day. She adored her, and had pictured her invariably in lilac. But now, seeing her in black, she felt that she had not fully seen her charm. She saw her now as someone quite new and surprising to her. Now she understood that Anna could not have been in lilac, and that her charm was just that she always stood out from her attire, that her dress could never be conspicuous on her. And her black dress, with its sumptuous lace, was not conspicuous on her. It was only the frame, and all that was seen was she, simple, natural, elegant, and at the same time gay and animated. She was standing, holding herself, as always, very erect, and when Kitty drew near the group she was speaking to the host, her head slightly turned toward him.
"No, I don't throw stones," she was saying in answer to something. "Though I can't understand it," she went on, shrugging her shoulders.
And she turned at once with a soft smile of protection toward Kitty. With a rapid feminine glance she scanned her attire, and made a movement of her head, hardly perceptible, but understood by Kitty, signifying approval of her dress and her looks.
"You came into the room dancing," she added.
"This is one of my most faithful supporters," said Korsunsky, bowing to Anna Arkadyevna, whom he had not yet seen. "The princess helps to make balls happy and successful," he said, bending down to her.
"Why, have you met?" inquired their host.
"Is there anyone we have not met? My wife and I are like white wolves. Everyone knows us," answered Korsunsky.
"A waltz, Anna Arkadyevna?" "I don't dance when it's possible not to dance," she said.
"But tonight it's impossible," answered Korsunsky.
At that instant Vronsky came up.
"Well, since it's impossible tonight, let us start," she said, ignoring Vronsky's bow, and she hastily put her hand on Korsunsky's shoulder. "Why is she vexed with him?" thought Kitty, discerning that Anna had intentionally not responded to Vronsky's bow. Vronsky went up to Kitty, reminding her of the first quadrille, and expressing his regret that he had not seen her all this time. Kitty gazed in admiration at Anna waltzing, and listened to him. She expected him to ask her for a waltz, but he didn't, and she glanced at him with surprise. He flushed slightly and hurriedly asked her to waltz, but he had just put his arm round her waist and taken the first step when the music suddenly stopped. Kitty looked into his face, which was so close to her own, and long afterward, for several years after, that look, full of love, she gave him, to which he made no response, cut her to the heart with an agony of shame.
"Pardon, pardon! Waltz! Waltz!" shouted Kozunsky from the other side of the room, and seizing the first young lady he came across, he himself began dancing.
Chapter 23 Vronsky and Kitty waltzed several times around the room. After the first waltz, Kitty went to her mother, and she had hardly time to say a few words to Countess Nordstrom when Vronsky came up again for the first quadrille. During the quadrille, nothing special was said. There was disjointed talk between them of the Kosunskys, husband and wife, whom he described very amusingly as delightful children at 40, and of the future town theatre. And only once did the conversation touch her to the quick when he asked her about Levin, whether he was here, and added that he liked him very much. But Kitty didn't expect much from the quadrille. Her heart thrilled in anticipation of the mazurka. It seemed to her that in the mazurka everything must be decided. The fact that he didn't, during the quadrille, ask her for the mazurka didn't trouble her. She felt sure she would dance a mazurka with him as she had done at former balls, and refused five young men, saying she was engaged for the mazurka. The whole ball, up to the last quadrille, was, for Kitty, an enchanted vision of delightful colours, sounds, and motions. She sat down only when she felt too tired, and begged for a rest. But as she was dancing the last quadrille with one of the tiresome young men whom she couldn't refuse, she chanced to be vis-à-vis with Vronsky and Anna. She hadn't been near Anna since the beginning of the evening, and now again she saw her suddenly quite new and surprising. She saw in her the signs of that thrill she knew so well in herself. She saw that she was intoxicated with the delighted admiration she was exciting. She knew that feeling, and knew its signs, and saw them in Anna, saw the quivering, flashing light in her eyes, and the smile of happiness and excitement unconsciously playing on her lips, and the deliberate grace, precision, and lightness of her movements. "Who?" she asked herself. "All? Or one?" And not assisting the harassed young man she was dancing with in the conversation, the thread of which he had lost and could not pick up again, she obeyed with external liveliness the peremptory shouts of Kosunsky, starting them all into the grand rond, and then into the chaîne, and at the same time she kept watch with a growing pang at her heart. No, it's not the admiration of the crowd that has intoxicated her, but the adoration of one. And that one, can it be he? Every time he spoke to Anna, the joyous light flashed into her eyes, and the smile of happiness curved her red lips. She seemed to make an effort to control herself, not to show these signs of delight, but they came out on her face by themselves. But what of him? Kitty looked at him and was filled with terror. What was pictured so clearly to Kitty in the mirror of Anna's face, she saw in him. What had become of his always self-possessed, resolute manner and the carelessly serene expression of his face? Now, every time he turned to her, he bent his head as though he would have fallen at her feet, and in his eyes there was nothing but humble submission and dread. "I would not offend you," his eyes seemed every time to be saying, "but I want to save myself, and I don't know how." On his face was a look such as Kitty had never seen before. They were speaking of common acquaintances, keeping up the most trivial conversation, but to Kitty it seemed that every word they said was determining their fate and hers. And strange it was that they were actually talking of how absurd Ivan Ivanovich was with his French, and how the Iletsky girl might have made a better match. Yet these words were important for them, and they felt just as Kitty did. The whole ball, the whole world, everything seemed lost in a mist in Kitty's soul. Nothing but the stern discipline of her upbringing supported her and forced her to do what was expected of her. That is, to dance, to answer questions, to talk, even to smile. But before the mazurka, when they were beginning to rearrange the chairs and a few couples moved out of the smaller rooms into the big room, a moment of despair and horror came for Kitty. She had refused 5 partners, and now she was not dancing the mazurka. She hadn't even a hope of being asked for it, because she was so successful in society that the idea would never occur to anyone that she had no partner. She would have to tell her mother she felt ill and go home, but she had not the strength to do this. She felt crushed. She went to the farthest end of the little drawing-room and sank into a low chair. Her airy skirts rose like a cloud above her slender waist, one bare, thin, soft, girlish arm, hanging listlessly, was lost in the folds of her pink tunic. In the other she held her fan, and with rapid, short strokes fanned her burning face. But while she looked like a butterfly clinging to a blade of grass, and just about to open its rainbow wings for fresh flight, her heart ached with horrible despair. "But perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps it was not so." And again she recalled all she had seen.
"Kitty, what is it?"
said Countess Nordston, stepping noiselessly over the carpet toward her.
"I don't understand it."
Kitty's lower lip began to quiver. She got up quickly.
"Kitty, you're not dancing the mazurka?"
"No, no," said Kitty in a voice shaking with tears.
"He asked her for the mazurka before me," said Countess Nordston, knowing Kitty would understand who he and her were. "She said, 'Why, aren't you going to dance it with Princess Cherchebatskaya?'
"Oh, I don't care," answered Kitty.
No one but herself understood her position. No one knew that she had just refused the man whom perhaps she loved, and refused him because she had put her faith in another. Countess Nordston found Kosunsky, with whom she was to dance the mazurka, and told him to ask Kitty. Kitty danced in the first pair, and luckily for her she didn't have to talk, because Kosunsky ran about directing the dancers. Vronsky and Anna sat almost opposite her. She saw them with her far-sighted eyes, and saw them, too, close by when they met in couples, and the more she saw of them, the more convinced was she that her unhappiness was complete. She saw that they felt themselves alone in that crowded room. And Vronsky's face, always so firm and independent, held that look that had struck her, of bewilderment and humble submissiveness, like the expression of an intelligent dog when it has done wrong. Anna smiled, and her smile was reflected by him. She grew thoughtful, and he became serious. Some supernatural force drew Kitty's eyes to Anna's face. She was enchanting in her simple black dress. Enchanting were her round arms with their bracelets. Enchanting was her firm neck with its thread of pearls. Fascinating the straying curls of her loose hair. Enchanting the graceful light movements of her little feet and hands. Enchanting was that lovely face in its animation. But there was something terrible and cruel about her charm. Kitty admired her more than ever, and more acute was her suffering. Kitty felt overwhelmed, and her face showed it. When Vronsky saw her during the mazurka, he didn't at once recognize her, so changed was she.
"Delightful ball," he said to her, for the sake of saying something.
"Yes," she answered.
In the middle of the mazurka, repeating a complicated figure newly invented by Kosunsky, Anna came forward into the center of the circle, chose 2 gentlemen, and summoned a lady and Kitty. Kitty gazed at her in dismay as she went up. Anna looked at her with drooping eyelids and smiled, pressing her hand. But noticing that Kitty responded to her smile only with a look of despair and amazement, she turned away from her and began gaily talking to the other lady.
"Yes, there is something uncanny, demonic, and fascinating in her," Kitty said to herself. Anna didn't mean to stay for supper, but the host began to insist that she stay.
"Nonsense," said Kosunsky, drawing her bare arm under the sleeve of his dress coat. "I've a marvellous idea for a cotillion. Un bijou."
And he moved gradually on, trying to draw her along with him,
Their host smiled approvingly. "No, I'm not going to stay," answered Anna, smiling. But in spite of her smile, both Korsunsky and the host saw from her resolute tone that she would not stay.
"No. Why, as it is, I have danced more at your ball in Moscow than I have all winter in Petersburg," said Anna, looking round at Vronsky, who stood near her. "I must rest a little before my journey."
"Are you really going tomorrow, then?" asked Vronsky.
"Yes, I suppose so," answered Anna, wondering at the boldness of his question, but the irrepressible flashing brilliance of her eyes and her smile set him on fire as she said it.
Anna Arkadyevna didn't stay to supper, but went home. Chapter 24.
"Yes, there is something in me repulsive and repellent," thought Levin as he came away from the Shcherbatskys and walked in the direction of his brother's lodgings. "And I don't get on with other people. Pride, they say. No, I have no pride. If I had any pride, I wouldn't have put myself in such a position." And he pictured to himself Vronsky, happy, good-natured, clever, and self-possessed, certainly never placed in the awful position in which he had been that evening. Yes, she was bound to choose him. So it had to be, and I can't complain of anyone or anything. I am myself to blame. What right had I to imagine she would care to join her life to mine? Who am I, and what am I? A nobody, not wanted by anyone or of any use to anybody. And he recalled his brother Nikolai, and dwelt with pleasure on the thought of him. Isn't he right that everything in the world is base and loathsome? And are we fair in our judgment of brother Nikolai? Of course, from Prokofy's point of view, seeing him in a torn coat and tipsy, he's a despicable person, but I know him differently. I know his soul, and know that we are like him. And I, instead of going to seek him out, went out to dinner and came here. Levin walked up to a lamppost and read his brother's address, which was in his notebook, and called a sleigh. During the long ride to his brother's, Levin vividly recalled all the facts familiar to him of Nikolai's life. He remembered how his brother, while at the university, and for a year afterward, had, in spite of the jeers of his companions, lived like a monk, strictly observing all religious rites, services, and fasts, and avoiding every sort of pleasure, especially women. And afterward, how he had all at once broken loose. He had associated with the most horrible people, and rushed into the most senseless debauchery. He remembered later the scandal over a boy whom he had taken from the country to bring up, and, in a fit of rage, had so violently beaten that proceedings were brought against him for causing bodily damage. Then he recalled the scandal with a card shark, to whom he had lost money and given a promissory note, and against whom he had himself lodged a complaint, asserting that he had cheated him. This was the money Sergei Ivanovitch had paid. Then he remembered how he had spent a night in the police station for disorderly conduct in the street. He remembered the shameful proceedings he had tried to instigate against his brother Sergei Ivanovitch, accusing him of not having paid him his share of his mother's fortune. And the last scandal, when he had gone to a western province in an official capacity, and there had got into trouble for assaulting a village elder. It was all horribly disgusting. Yet to Levin it appeared not at all in the same disgusting light as it inevitably would to those who didn't know Nikolai, did not know his whole story, didn't know his heart. Levin remembered that when Nikolai had been in the devout stage, the period of fasts and monks and church services, when he was seeking in religion a support and a curb for his passionate temperament, everyone, far from encouraging him, had jeered at him. And he, too, with the others. They had teased him, called him Noah and Monk, and when he had broken loose, no one had helped him. Everyone had turned away from him in horror and disgust. Levin felt that in spite of all the ugliness of his life, his brother Nikolai, in his soul, in the very depths of his soul, was no more in the wrong than the people who despised him. He was not to blame for having been born with his unbridled temperament and his somehow constrained intelligence. He'd always wanted to be good. "I will talk frankly, without reserve,"
and I'll make him speak without reserve too. And I'll show him that I love him and so understand him, Levin resolved to himself, as, toward 11 o'clock, he reached the hotel.
At the top, 12 and 13,
the porter said in answer to Levin's inquiry. At home?
Sure to be at home.
The door of number 12 was half open, and into the streak of light came thick fumes of cheap, foul tobacco, and the sound of a voice unknown to Levin. But he knew at once that his brother was there. He heard his cough. As he went up to the door, the unknown voice was saying,
"It all depends with how much judgment and knowledge the thing's done."
Konstantin Levin looked in at the door and saw that the speaker was a young man with an immense shock of hair, wearing a Russian coat, and that a pockmarked woman in a wool gown without collar or cuffs was sitting on the sofa. His brother was not to be seen. Konstantin felt a sharp pang at his heart at the thought of the strange company in which his brother spent his life. No one had heard him, and Konstantin, taking off his galoshes, listened to what the man in the coat was saying. He was speaking of some enterprise.
"To hell with the privileged classes," his brother's voice responded with a cough. "Masha, get us some supper and some wine if there's any left, or else go and get some."
The woman rose, came out from behind the screen, and saw Konstantin.
"There's some gentleman, Nikolai Dmitrievich," she said. "Whom do you want?" said the voice of Nikolai Levin angrily.
"It's me," answered Konstantin Levin, coming forward into the light.
"Who's me?"
Nikolai's voice said again, still more angrily. He could be heard getting up hurriedly, stumbling against something, and Levin saw, facing him in the doorway, the big scared eyes and the huge, thin, stooping figure of his brother, so familiar, and yet so astonishing in its weirdness and sickliness. He was even thinner than 3 years before when Konstantin had seen him last. He was wearing a short coat, and his arms and his large hands seemed bigger than ever. His hair had grown thinner, the same walrus moustache hid his lips. The same eyes gazed strangely and naively at his visitor.
"Ah, Kostya!"
he exclaimed suddenly, recognizing his brother, and his eyes lighted up with joy. But at the same second he looked around at the young man, and gave the nervous jerk of his head and neck that Konstantin knew so well, as if his neckband hurt him, and a quite different expression, wild, suffering, and cruel, settled on his emaciated face.
"I wrote to you and Sergei Ivanovich both that I don't know you and don't want to know you. What is it that you want?"
He was not at all the same as Konstantin had imagined him. The worst and most tiresome part of his character, that which made all relations with him so difficult, had been forgotten by Konstantin Levin when he thought of him. But now, when he saw his face, and especially that nervous twitching of his head, he remembered it all.
"I don't want anything," he answered timidly. "I've simply come to see you."
His brother's timidity obviously softened Nikolai. His lips twitched.
"Oh, so that's it," he said. "Well, come in, sit down. Like some supper? Masha, bring supper for three. No, wait a minute. Do you know who this is?" he said, addressing his brother and indicating the gentleman in the coat. "This is Kritsky, my friend from Kiev. A very remarkable man. He's persecuted by the police, of course, because he's not a scoundrel."
And he looked around in the way he always did at everyone in the room. Seeing that the woman standing in the doorway was starting to leave, he shouted to her,
"Wait a minute, I said."
And with the inability to express himself, the incoherence that Konstantin knew so well, he began, with another look round at everyone, to tell his brother Kritsky's story. How he had been expelled from the university for starting a benefit society for the poor students and Sunday schools, and how he had afterward been a teacher in a peasant school, and how he had been driven out of that too, and had afterward been condemned for something or other.
"You're of the Kiev University," said Konstantin Levin to Kritsky to break the awkward silence that followed. "Yes, I was of Kiev,"
Kritsky replied angrily, his face darkening.
"And this woman," Nikolai Levin interrupted him, pointing to her,
is my life's companion, Maria Nikolaevna. I took her out of a whorehouse, and he jerked his neck saying this. But I love her and respect her. And anyone who wants to know me, he added, raising his voice and knitting his brows, I beg to love her and respect her. She's just the same as my wife, just the same. So now you know whom you're dealing with. And if you think you're lowering yourself, well, here's the floor, and there's the door.
And again, his eyes travelled inquiringly over all of them.
Why should I be lowering myself? I don't understand. Then, Masha, tell them to bring supper, 3 portions, vodka and wine. No, wait a minute. No, it doesn't matter. Run along.
Chapter 25.
So, you see, pursued Nikolai Levin, painfully wrinkling his forehead and twitching. It was obviously difficult for him to think of what to say and do. Here, do you see?
He pointed to some iron bars tied together with string lying in a corner of the room.
Do you see that? That's the beginning of a new thing we're going into. It's a productive association.
Konstantin scarcely heard him. He looked into his sickly, consumptive face, and he was more and more sorry for him, and he couldn't force himself to listen to what his brother was telling him about the association. He saw that this association was a mere anchor to save him from self-contempt. Nikolai Levin went on talking.
You know that capital oppresses the labourer. Our labourers, the peasants, bear all the burden of labour, and so are placed that however much they work, they can't escape from their position of beast of burden. All the profits of labour, on which they might improve their position and gain leisure for themselves, and after that education, all the surplus values are taken from them by the capitalists. And society is so constituted that the harder they work, the greater the profit of the merchants and the landowners, while they stay beasts of burden to the end.
And that state of things must be changed,
he finished up, and he looked questioningly at his brother.
Yes, of course, said Konstantin, looking at the patch of red that had come out on his brother's projecting cheekbones.
And so, we're forming a locksmith's association where all the production and profit and the chief instruments of production will be in common.
Where is this association to be? Asked Konstantin Levin.
In the village of Vozdrem, Kazansky province.
But why in a village?
I should think that in the villages there is plenty of work as it is.
Why a locksmith's association in a village?
Why? Because the peasants are just as much slaves as they ever were. And that's why you and Sergei Ivanovich don't like people to try and get them out of their slavery, said Nikolai Levin, exasperated by the objection.
Konstantin Levin sighed, looking meanwhile about the cheerless and dirty room. This sigh seemed to exasperate Nikolai still more.
I know your and Sergei Ivanovich's aristocratic views. I know that he applies all the power of his intellect to justify existing evils.
No.
And why do you talk of Sergei Ivanovich? Said Levin, smiling.
Sergei Ivanovich, I'll tell you why.
Nikolai Levin shrieked suddenly at the name of Sergei Ivanovich.
I'll tell you why. But what's the use of talking? There's only one thing. What did you come here for? You despise this, and that's all right. Then go away, in God's name, go away, he shrieked, getting up from his chair. Go away, go away.
I don't look down on it at all, said Konstantin Levin timidly. I don't even dispute it.
At that instant, Maria Nikolaevna came back. Nikolai Levin looked round angrily at her. She went quickly to him and whispered something.
I'm not well. I've grown irritable, said Nikolai Levin, getting calmer and breathing painfully.
And you talk to me of Sergei Ivanovich and his article. It's such rubbish, such lying, such self-deception. What can a man write of justice who knows nothing of it? Have you read his article?
He asked Kritsky, sitting down again at the table and brushing from it a pile of half-filled cigarettes so as to provide space.
I've not read it.
Kritsky responded gloomily, obviously not desiring to enter into the conversation.
Why not? Said Nikolai Levin, now turning with exasperation upon Kritsky.
Because I didn't see the use of wasting my time over it.
Oh, but excuse me, how did you know it would be wasting your time?
That article's too profound for many people, that is to say, it's over their heads. But with me, it's another thing. I see through his ideas, and I know where its weakness lies.
Everyone was mute. Kritsky got up deliberately and reached for his cap.
Won't you have supper?
All right, goodbye.
Come round tomorrow with the locksmith.
Kritsky had hardly gone out when Nikolai Levin smiled and winked.
He's no good either, he said.
I see, of course.
But at that instant, Kritsky, at the door, called him.
What do you want now? He said,
and went out to him in the passage. Left alone with Maria Nikolaevna, Levin turned to her.
Have you been with my brother long?
He said to her.
Yes, more than a year. And Nikolai Dmitrievich's health has become very poor. Nikolai Dmitrievich drinks a great deal, she said.
That is... What does he drink?
Vodka, and it's bad for him.
And a great deal, whispered Levin.
Yes,
she said, looking timidly toward the doorway where Nikolai Levin had reappeared.
What were you talking about?
He said, knitting his brows as turning from one to the other with frightened eyes.
What was it?
Oh, nothing, Konstantin answered in confusion.
Oh, if you don't want to say, don't. Only it's no good you talking to her. She's a whore, and you're a gentleman, he said, with a jerk of the neck. You understand everything, I see, and have taken stock of everything, and look with commiseration on my shortcomings,
he began again, raising his voice.
Nikolai Dmitrievich, Nikolai Dmitrievich,
whispered Maria Nikolaevna, again going up to him.
Oh, very well, very well. But where's the supper? Ah, here it is,
he said, seeing a waiter with a tray.
Here, set it here,
he added angrily, and promptly seizing the vodka, he poured out a glassful and drank it greedily.
Like a drink?
He turned to his brother and at once became better humoured.
Well, enough of Sergei Ivanovich. I'm glad to see you, anyway. After all said and done, we're not strangers. Come, have a drink.
Tell me what you're doing, he went on, greedily munching a piece of bread and pouring out another glassful.
How are you living?
I live alone in the country as I used to. I'm busy looking after the land, answered Konstantin,
watching with horror the greediness with which his brother ate and drank, and trying to conceal the fact that he noticed it.
Why don't you get married?
It just hasn't happened, Konstantin answered, reddening a little.
Why not? For me now. Well, everything's at an end. I've made a mess of my life, but this I've said, and I may say still, that if my share had been given me when I needed it, my whole life would have been different.
Konstantin made haste to change the conversation.
Do you know your little Vanyushka's with me? A clerk in my office at Prokhorovskoye.
Nikolai jerked his neck and sank into thought.
Yes. Tell me what's going on at Prokhorovskoye. Is the house still standing? And the birch trees and our schoolroom? And Philippe, the gardener, is he living? How I remember the arbour and the seat. Now, see that you don't alter anything in the house, but hurry up and get married and make everything as it used to be again. Then I'll come and see you, if your wife is nice.
But come to me now, said Levin. How nicely we would arrange it.
I'd come and see you if I were sure I would not find Sergei Ivanovich.
You wouldn't find him there. I live quite independently of him.
Yes, but say what you like. You'll have to choose between me and him,
he said, looking timidly into his brother's face. This timidity touched Konstantin.
If you want to hear my confession of faith on the subject, I tell you that in your quarrel with Sergei Ivanovitch, I take neither side. You're both wrong. You're more wrong externally, and he inwardly.
Aha! Oh, you see that? You see that? Nikolai shouted joyfully.
But I personally value friendly relations with you more because...
Why? Why?
Konstantin couldn't say that he valued it more because Nikolai was unhappy and needed affection. But Nikolai knew that this was just what he meant to say, and scowling, he took up the vodka again.
Enough, Nikolai Dmitrievich, said Maria Nikolaevna, stretching out her plump, bare arm toward the decanter. Let it be. Don't insist. I'll beat you, he shouted.
Maria Nikolaevna smiled a sweet and good-natured smile, which was at once reflected on Nikolai's face, and she took the bottle.
Do you suppose she understands nothing? Said Nikolai. She understands it all better than any of us. Isn't it true there's something good and sweet in her?
Were you never before in Moscow? Konstantin said to her, for the sake of saying something.
Don't say "vy" to her. It frightens her. No one ever said "vy" to her like that but the magistrate who tried her for trying to get out of a brothel. Heaven help us, the senselessness in the world, he cried suddenly. These new institutions, these magistrate courts, rural councils, how monstrous it all is!
And he began to enlarge on his encounters with the new institutions. Konstantin Levin heard him, and the disbelief in the sense of all public institutions, which he shared with him and often expressed, was distasteful to him now from his brother's lips.
In another world we shall understand it all, he said lightly. In another world? Oh, I don't like that other world. I don't like it, he said, letting his frightened eyes rest on his brother's. Here one would think that to get out of all the baseness and the mess, one's own and other people's, would be a good thing. Yet I'm afraid of death, terribly afraid of death.
He shuddered.
But drink something. Would you like some champagne? Or shall we go somewhere? Let's go to the gypsies. Do you know, I've grown fond of the gypsies and Russian songs.
His speech had begun to falter, and he passed abruptly from one subject to another. Konstantin, with Masha's help, persuaded him not to go out anywhere, and got him to bed, hopelessly drunk. Masha promised to write to Konstantin in case of need, and to persuade Nikolai Levin to go and stay with his brother. Chapter 26. In the morning, Konstantin Levin left Moscow, and towards evening he reached home. On the journey in the train, he talked to his neighbours about politics and the new railways, and just as in Moscow, he was overcome by a sense of confusion of ideas, dissatisfaction with himself, shame about something or other. But when he got out at his own station, when he saw his one-eyed coachman, Ignat, with the collar of his coat turned up, when, in the dim light reflected by the station lights, he saw his own sleigh, his own horses with their tails tied up, their harness trimmed with rings and tassels. When Ignat, as he put in his luggage, told him the village news, that the contractor had arrived, and that Pava had carved, he felt that little by little the confusion was clearing up, and the shame and self-dissatisfaction were passing away. He felt this at the mere sight of Ignat and the horses, but when he had put on the sheepskin brought to him, had sat down wrapped up in the sleigh, and had driven off pondering on the work that lay before him in the village, and staring at the side horse, once a saddle horse, worn out now, but a spirited beast from the Don, he began to see what had happened to him in quite a different light. He felt that he was himself, and didn't want to be anyone else. All he wanted now was to be better than before. First, he resolved that from that day he would give up hoping for any extraordinary happiness, such as marriage might have given him, and consequently would not so disparage what he really had. Second, he would never again let himself give way to disgusting passion, the memory of which had so tortured him when he had been making up his mind to make a proposal. Then, remembering his brother Nikolai, he resolved that he would never allow himself to forget him, that he would follow him up and not lose sight of him,
so as to be ready to help should things go badly with him. And that would be soon, he felt. Then, too, his brother's talk of communism, which he had treated so lightly at the time, now made him think. He considered a revolution in economic conditions nonsense. But he always felt the injustice of his own abundance in comparison with the poverty of the peasants, and now he determined that so as to feel completely in the right, though he had worked hard and lived by no means luxuriously before, he would now work still harder, and would allow himself even less luxury. And all this seemed to him so easy a conquest over himself that he spent the whole drive in the pleasantest daydreams. With a resolute feeling of hope in a new, better life, he reached home before 9 o'clock at night. The snow of the little quadrangle before the house was lit up by a light in the bedroom windows of his old nurse, Agafia Mikhailovna, who performed the duties of housekeeper in his house. She was not yet asleep. Kuzma, wakened by her, came sidling sleepily out onto the steps. A setter bitch, Laska, ran out too, almost upsetting Kuzma, and whining, the dog circled Levin's knees, jumping up and longing, but not daring, to put her forepaws on his chest.
"You're back early, sir," said Agafia Mikhailovna.
"I got tired of it, Agafia Mikhailovna. Visiting friends is all very well, but there's no place like home," he answered, and went into his study.
The study was gradually lit up as the candle was brought in. The familiar details came out, the stag's horns, the bookshelves, the mirror, the stove with its ventilator, which had long been in need of fixing, his father's sofa, a large table, on the table an open book, a broken ashtray, a notebook with his writing. As he saw all this, there came over him for an instant a doubt of the possibility of starting a new life, of which he had been dreaming on the road. All these traces of his life seemed to clutch him and say to him, "No, you're not going to get away from us, and you're not going to be different. You're going to be the same as you've always been, with doubts, everlasting dissatisfaction with yourself, vain efforts to improve, and failures, and continual expectation of a happiness that has eluded you and that isn't possible for you." This the thing said to him. But another voice in his heart was telling him that he mustn't fall under the sway of the past, and that one can do anything with oneself. And hearing that voice, he went into the corner where his 2 36-pound dumbbells were, and began exercising with them like a gymnast, trying to restore his self-confidence. There was a creak of steps at the door. He hastily put down the dumbbells. The bailiff came in, and said that everything, thank God, was doing well, but informed him that the buckwheat in the new drying kiln had been a little scorched. This piece of news irritated Levin. The new kiln had been constructed and partly invented by Levin. The bailiff had always been against the kiln, and now it was with suppressed triumph that he announced that the buckwheat had been scorched. Levin was firmly convinced that if the buckwheat had been scorched, it was only because the precautions had not been taken, for which he had hundreds of times given orders. He was annoyed and reprimanded the bailiff. But there had been an important and joyful event. Pava, his best cow, an expensive animal, bought at a cattle show, had calved. "Kuzma, give me my sheepskin. And you tell them to take a lantern. I'll come and look at her," he said to the bailiff. The sheds for the more valuable cows were just behind the house. Walking across the yard, passing a snowdrift by the lilac bush, he went into the shed. There was the warm, steamy smell of dung when the frozen door was opened, and the cows, startled at the unfamiliar light of the lantern, stirred on the fresh straw. He caught a glimpse of the broad, smooth, black-and-white back of a Dutch cow. Bakut, the bull, was lying down with his ring in his nose, and seemed about to get up, but thought better of it, and only gave 2 snorts as they passed by him. Pava, a perfect beauty, as huge as a hippopotamus, with her back turned to them, prevented their seeing the calf as she sniffed her all over. Levin went into the pen, looked Pava over, and lifted the red and spotted calf onto her long, tottering legs. Pava, uneasy, began lowing, but when Levin put the calf close to her, she was soothed, and sighing heavily, began licking her with her rough tongue. The calf, fumbling, poked her nose under her mother's udder, and stiffened her tail out straight.
Here, bring the light, Fyodor, this way, said Levin, examining the calf.
Like the mother, though the colour is like the father's, but that's nothing.
Very good. Long and broad in the haunch.
Vasily Fedorovitch, isn't she marvellous? He said to the bailiff, quite forgiving him for the buckwheat under the influence of his delight in the calf.
How could she fail to be?
Oh, Semyon the contractor came the day after you left.
You must settle with him, Konstantin Dmitrievich, said the bailiff.
I did inform you about the machine.
This question was enough to take Levin back to all the details of his work on the estate, which was on a large scale and complicated. He went straight from the cowshed to the office, and after a little conversation with the bailiff and Semyon, the contractor, he went back to the house and straight upstairs to the drawing room. Chapter 27
The house was big and old-fashioned, and Levin, though he lived alone, had the whole house heated and used all of it. He knew that this was stupid. He knew that it was positively wrong and contrary to his present new plans. But this house was a whole world to Levin. It was the world in which his father and mother had lived and died. They had lived just the life that to Levin seemed the ideal of perfection and that he had dreamed of renewing with his wife, with his own family. Levin scarcely remembered his mother. His conception of her was for him a sacred memory, and his future wife was bound to be, in his imagination, a repetition of that exquisite, holy ideal of a woman that his mother had been. He was so far from conceiving of love for women apart from marriage that he actually pictured to himself first the family, and only secondarily the woman who would give him a family. His ideas of marriage were, consequently, very unlike those of the great majority of his acquaintances, for whom getting married was one of the numerous facts of social life. For Levin, it was the chief affair of life on which its whole happiness turned, and now he had to give that up. When he had gone into the little drawing-room where he always had tea, and had settled himself in his armchair with a book, and Agafia Mikhailovna had brought him tea, and with her usual, "Well, I'll stay a while, sir," had seated herself at the window, he felt that, however strange it might be, he had not parted from his daydreams, and that he couldn't live without them. Whether with her or with another, still it would be. He was reading a book, and thinking of what he was reading, and stopping to listen to Agafia Mikhailovna, who gossiped away without stopping. And yet, with all that, all sorts of pictures of family life and work in the future rose disconnectedly before his imagination. He felt that in the depth of his soul something had been put in its place, settled down, and laid to rest. He heard Agafia Mikhailovna talking of how Prochor had forgotten his duty to God, and, with the money Levin had given him to buy a horse, had been drinking without stopping, and had beaten his wife till he'd half killed her. He listened, and read his book, and recalled the whole train of his ideas suggested by his reading. It was Tyndall's Treatise on Heat. He recalled his own criticism of Tyndall for his complacent satisfaction in the cleverness of his experiments, and for his lack of philosophic insight. And suddenly there floated into his mind the joyful thought, "In 2 years' time I shall have 2 Dutch cows. Parva herself will perhaps still be alive, 12 young daughters of Berkut, and to top it off, these 3. How wonderful!" He took up his book again. "Very good. Electricity and heat are the same thing, but is it possible to substitute the one quantity for the other in the equation for the solution of any problem? No. Well, then, what of it? The connection between all the forces of nature is felt instinctively. It's particularly nice if Parva's daughter should be a red-spotted cow, and all the herd will take after her, and the other 3 too. Splendid! To go out with my wife and visitors to meet the herd. My wife will say, 'Kostya and I looked after that calf like a child.' 'How could it interest you so much?' says a visitor. 'Everything that interests him interests me.' But who will she be?" And then he remembered what had happened in Moscow. "Well, there's nothing to be done. It's not my fault. But now everything shall go on in a new way.
Well, it's nonsense to pretend that life won't allow it, that the past won't allow it. One must struggle to live better, much better.
He raised his head and sank into thought. Old Lasker, who had not yet fully digested her delight at his return, and had run out into the yard to bark, came back wagging her tail and crept up to him, bringing in the scent of the fresh air, put her head under his hand, and whined plaintively, asking to be petted.
"There, who'd have thought it?" said Agafea Mikhailovna. "The dog now. Why, she understands that her master's come home and that he's depressed."
"Why depressed?"
"Do you suppose I don't see it, sir? It's high time I should know the gentry. Why, I've grown up from a little thing with them. It's nothing, sir, so long as there's health and a clear conscience."
Levin looked intently at her, surprised at how well she knew his thought.
"Shall I fetch you another cup?" she said.
And taking his cup, she went out. Laska kept poking her head under his hand. He petted her, and she promptly curled up at his feet, laying her head on a hind paw. And, in token of everything now being satisfactory, she opened her mouth a little, smacked her lips, and settling her sticky lips more comfortably about her old teeth, sank into blissful repose. Levin watched all of her movements attentively. "That's what I'll do," he said to himself.
"That's what I'll do. Nothing's wrong. All's well."